Good morning, Oregon. Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John from Offbeat Oregon History. Today's Thursday and I'm doing my book reading today. Most Thursdays I do a reading from an awesome book on Oregon history, starting with the first part and then give you information about where you can go and get it. I've got one all queued up to do that with, but I haven't been able to read it yet because it's been a busy week. So instead of doing that, I'm going to read another chapter of Shanghaiing Days. Shanghaiing Days by Richard H. Dillon is copyright 1961. The copyright expired, was not renewed, and passed into the public domain in the late 1980s. I will be reading Chapter 2, titled Sky Pilots and Pen Pushers. Among the earliest men to take up cudgels in behalf of America's oppressed merchant seamen were Reverend Lyman Beecher of Boston and Samuel C. Damon, the esteemed seaman's chaplain of Honolulu. Another less well-known defender was the Reverend William Taylor, known universally as Father Taylor. Taylor was by inclination and by training in Baltimore and Washington a street preacher, adept in exhorting crowds al fresco. This training fitted him ideally for a San Francisco pastorate in 1849, since there were no Protestant churches yet built there. About the only houses of the Lord were temporary salt-stained deckhouses aboard hulks in the bay, which did duty as seamen's Bethels. In the fall of 1848, while passing up Baltimore Street in the monumental city, Taylor was hailed by an old duffer called Christian Kenner. The old man hurried up to him and exclaimed that Bishop Woe wanted to see him at once in Armstrong and Berry's bookstore. Taylor made his way there, where the bishop informed him that he was ready to send him as a missionary to California, provided he had no objection. On the contrary, Taylor was delighted with the new challenge. He bundled his family aboard a Baltimore clipper, despite the charges of his friends that he was guilty of cruelty toward his loved ones for transporting them to such a barbarous land. And on September 21st, 1849, Captain Wilson brought the Andalusia into San Francisco Bay. Never having entered the harbor, he ran a bit north off Point Reyes and then headed into the fog which shrouded the port. Like a miracle, the wet curtain parted and they found themselves in bright California sunshine as they passed inside the fog belt. Ducks and pelicans by the thousands welcomed the vessel. Playful whales spouted and dived within 30 yards of the ship, being repaid for their good spirits with pistol balls from the more brutal passengers. Captain Wilson skillfully brought the clipper to shore without a pilot, culminating a trip of 5 months and 3 days from Baltimore. A brother of one of the passengers came aboard that night and was pumped dry of all information and misinformation that he possessed on the city. He spoke the truth in saying that cooks were worth $300 a month, but that gamblers were the aristocracy of the new city, since theirs was the most profitable and thus the most respectable business for a gentleman to follow. Taylor put the question to him, "Are there no ministers of the gospel or churches in the place?" "Yes," said the San Franciscan. "We have one preacher, but preaching won't pay here, so he quit preaching and went to gambling. There is but one church in town, and that has been converted into a jail." When the gentleman was told that the Reverend Taylor had a knockdown church on board, he told the parson to sell the church by all means. It would never be used for that purpose, of course, but he could easily realize $10,000 on it as a gambling den. The hard-shelled Taylor refused. The next morning, the passengers went ashore. Taylor found the man's claims all true, except that no church had been made into a jail. It was the town schoolhouse on Portsmouth Plaza that had been pressed into use to hold the ruffians who were descending on the city. Taylor set out to find news of his fellow missionary, Isaac Owens, who had started overland for California, and then inquired after any Methodist families, or Christian families in general, who might need his services. While the Methodist chapel was going up, the slim congregation met in what was known as the shanty with the blue cover. Taylor went across the bay to the Contra Costa, climbed the Coast Range hills and the redwood groves, and cut out single-handedly a two-story house, 16 by 26 feet, for his parsonage. He did not forget to make 3,000 shingles either. Father Taylor devoted himself to getting his church finished and to converting souls. In doing the latter, he made quite a splash by preaching in Portsmouth Plaza, directly opposite the dens of iniquity of the gambling fraternity, the plush El Dorado and Parker House. Some of his brethren felt the card sharps would actually shoot him down in the street if he preached against betting, but Taylor's sermon was a success after he had broken the ice by singing a hymn. He found himself surrounded by more than 1,000 curious men. His success at soul-saving could not be described in stronger terms than moderate, however, for after a week of preaching every night, the net result was, quote, 3 persons who professed to experience religion. On the other hand, he once collected $400 by passing a hat in the plaza after preaching in behalf of his Seaman's Bethel. Father Taylor became particularly interested in sailors via his contacts with them while he was doing chaplain's duty to 500 patients of the United States Marine Hospital on Rincon Point. The building was erected on land given the federal government by the city at a cost of $220,000 taken from a fund created by a tax of 25 cents per head levied on American merchant seamen, deducted from their wages by shipmasters and then paid in at the customs house. In return for this fee, every sailor was entitled to what amounted to an early form of health insurance. In case of illness, he could apply for a certificate of admission from the collector of port and thus would not have to take his chances as a charity patient in the city hospital. By dint of hard work, Taylor was able to save a number of seamen during his 7 hours of preaching at the Marine Hospital, in the streets, on the long wharf, on steamer docks, atop benches, whiskey barrels, and brandy casks in the Embarcadero. Even notorious A.M. Brown, quote, extremely wicked and profane, an avowed enemy of Christ and his church, and especially of missionaries in foreign fields, gave in to the persuasive parson. After successfully organizing the Methodist Episcopal Church on Powell Street and serving there 2 years as pastor, Taylor established a Seaman's Bethel composed of a church for sailors and a home for shipwrecked and destitute mariners. He started without a dollar's worth of help and in 2 years had the best church in the state. Yet Taylor's evangelizing and revivalism, and that of other men of the cloth, had little if any lasting effect on the men of the sea he met. He was certainly able to do nothing to alleviate the miserable conditions in which Americans existed aboard ship or even shore, where they fell under the tender mercies of Shanghaiing landlords and saloon keepers. Most of them tossed off their religious lessons with a joke like the following, a popular description by a San Francisco sailor of what is a Christian. The sailor stated, "There is a clothing merchant up in Boston who keeps the command of the scriptures where it says, 'Thou shalt take the stranger in.' I was a stranger, and he took me in bad on a pea coat I bought from him." Taylor deplored what seemed to be the occupational disease of sailormen, drunkenness. However, he never seemed to realize, much less grapple with, the real cause of sailors leaning on a whiskey bottle as a crutch. He, like so many temperance touters, missed the point. He would sermonize, "Why do you drink? Because it gratifies your vitiated appetite. Every repetition, as you imagine, increases the gratification. The absence of this gratification creates, as a man said to me one day after preaching on the long wharf, a terrible pain down in here which must be relieved, and thus by the combined forces of the pleasure and the pain occasioned by the absence of it, your desire for the deadly cup becomes more and more imperative." The pastor should have realized the why of drunkenness among sailors. In the bottle, they sought relief, escape from a brutal system condoned by society. William B., a visitor to Taylor's Bethel, told him of his experience before the mast. Quote,
"I shipped in the brig CF, Captain P., from Baltimore. After we got out to sea, the captain flogged me regularly 3 times a day all the way out and called me by no other name than 'you son of a bitch.' One occasion he said to me, 'I believe whipping don't hurt you much, so now I am going to punish you.' He took me and tied me over the hawse pipe at the bows where I was drenched with seawater at every dip of the brig. I remained there in soak without a bite to eat for 3 days and nights. The captain also beat the cook till he jumped overboard and then lowered a boat and beat him in the water and took him up just in time to save his life."
Small wonder William B. became a wild drinking boy, 19 years of age. Hazing and flogging, the latter abolished in the Navy but still part of merchant service discipline, were enough to drive anyone to drink. The first out-and-out attack on the nefarious practice of crimping on the Pacific coast was a sermon delivered by Taylor to an attentive audience in September 1855 in Portsmouth Plaza. He later wrote it out from memory. It is one of the most important sermons ever delivered in Frisco. Taylor was one of the first to use the term Shanghaiing, a San Francisco word which eventually replaced in most ports the older term, crimping. He called his sermon, Shanghaiing the Sailors. After paying tribute to the sailors' role in American commerce and history and reminding his listeners of the hard and dangerous life which they lived, Taylor ventured the opinion that the United States merchant seamen, quote,
"if Christianized themselves,
would be the most successful auxiliaries to missionaries in spreading the gospel in heathen lands." A number of his listeners retorted, "but we can more easily convert the heathen than the sailors." Now the sailor's padre began to warm to his subject. Quote,
"What class of men so deserving has been so neglected in the past? The extent of the abuse they have suffered in home and foreign ports by the Land Shark Fraternity, a system of abuse familiarly known in California under the title Shanghaiing, has never been learned by the mass of the people, a mystery of iniquity, the enormity of which the light of eternity only can reveal. The system of Shanghaiing, to which I invite attention, is almost as ancient as commerce of nations, but the term Shanghaiing is a modern California name, the origin of which I will give to you in due time. I say system of Shanghaiing because it embraces a combination of laws and forces employed by a combination of men for the accomplishment of a specific end, namely to reduce to a state of perfect vassalage and voluntary serfdom the millions of men who go down the sea in ships, and to gather all the fruits of their toils. The secret motto of the system is, get the sailor's money, honestly if most convenient, but get it. A single Shanghaiing fraternity, and we have 23 of them along our waterfront, embraces 1. A sailor landlord, alias land shark, alias Shanghaier. 2. A drayman. 3. A longshoreman. 4. A sailor lawyer. 5. A shipping master. The sailor landlord keeps a sailor boarding house, bar, etc. The longshoreman mans with a pair of oars a Whitehall boat. The sailor lawyer prosecutes suits against captains and owners of vessels and otherwise collects seamen's wages, damages for maltreatment, etc. The shipping master provides crews for the ships as they clear by contract with the shipmaster for $5 per head. The captain of the vessel ships none of his men directly. They must all come to him through the shipping office where the shipping articles are kept for signature. The whole contract for the voyage with the crew is made by the shipping master, who is to see them aboard at the hour of sailing, and the captain has nothing to do with them till he gives the order for sailing. The advance wages are paid not in money, lest the sailor should spend it and then refuse to go to sea, but by a check on the shipping office to be paid 3 days after the ship sails. The shipmaster, it will be seen, is not a party in the Shanghaiing business, and the shipping master is a party from necessity rather than from design, as we will show, and may nevertheless be an honorable man. The lawyer may by possibility be an honorable man, but he will bear watching. We now will show you the practical working of the system. A ship is telegraphed and the longshoreman is ready with his boat. He is in the stream and listening for the command, "Let go the anchor!" Immediately he is on deck and perfectly delighted to meet his poor brother seaman from a long voyage. "How are you, fellows? I'm glad to see you. You've got to the right port at last, the most glorious country in the world, a regular godsend for poor sailors. A crew came in last week and left their ship as they all do here, and now every man of them is getting $100 a month to stay ashore. If you'll come along with me and put up at our house, I have chances awaiting, and you shall have work ashore at once and wages that are wages." Thus he decoys the entire crew. Sometimes he takes them right away in defiance of the captain. On one occasion, a captain ran out with a small derringer in his hand, and the longshoreman said, "Captain, what are you doing with that thing?" "If you interfere with my men," replied the captain, "I'll put a ball through you." The boatman, pulling out one of Colt's large revolvers, said, "Here, captain, take this. That little thing is of no account." And turning on his heel, he said to the crew, "Come on, boys, pass down your dunnage here into my boat. I'll take care of you." They all went in spite of the captain's threats, but the usual method is to make an appointment with the crew to have the boat alongside at a certain watch of the night. The boys all get ready at the hour appointed. Their faithful friend, who has promised to emancipate them from the horrors of a sailor's life, is on hand and bears them to the wharf. The drayman is waiting on the wharf with his dray on which their dunnage is transferred from the boat, and now all hands march together up to the home. The landlord greets them with a hearty "Shake hands! Welcome to my house, my good fellows. You've had a hard time of it, I know. I am prepared to sympathize with you, for I am a regular old salt myself. I'm glad you've come to this glorious country. Walk in, and make yourselves at home. Everything in this world you want, you shall have while you stay with me." Now all hands must stand treat. The landlord treats, the longshoreman treats, the drayman and each sailor treats, and by this time the whole crew is drunk, unless perchance there may be one who has signed the pledge. The longshoreman and the drayman now demand their money, which the landlord pays, $10 a head for decoying and bringing ashore, and $5 a head for the drayman, and charges it to the sailor's accounts. And all the drinks, real and imaginary, are also set to their account. The lawyer now comes in, and through the landlord gets their claims against the ship, which he collects either by compromise or a lawsuit. as may best suit the convenience of the captain, half of which he keeps for his trouble and the other half over to the landlord on behalf of the sailors. Next comes the shipping master, who says, "I want 20 men for the ship Water Witch by 5 o'clock this afternoon." "Very good," says the landlord, "you shall have them." And often the very crew that came in that morning are shipped before they recover from the first drunk. When they wake up from their golden dreams, they find themselves at sea in a strange ship, minus their back in advance wages and most of their clothing. A part of their clothing they find in their chests and a bottle of whiskey to keep to sober up on and to remember their friend the landlord. When the sailor's bill at the boarding house runs up to cover the advance, the landlord says to him, "Jack, you must ship." "I won't do it," says Jack. "You shall do it. You owe me $100, and you must either pay it today or go to sea in the ship Challenge." "But I don't want to go to sea yet," says Jack. "Oh, well, never mind," says the landlord. "You're a clever fellow. You may stay at my house as long as you please and pay me when you are ready. Come, let's take a drink." Jack, very glad to be on so good terms with the landlord, walks up to the bar and drinks to the health of his master. In 10 minutes, he is insensible as a log. When he recovers from this mysterious sleep, he is out of sight of land. He is awakened by the stern command, "Wake up and get to work." The poor fellow, rubbing his eyes, inquires, "What ship is this? Whither bound?" "To Hong Kong." "How did I get here?" "Why, you shipped," says the master. "I never shipped in this ship." "Yes, you did, and you must go to work without any more grumbling," replies the captain sternly. "I want to see the articles," says the sailor. "Well, sir, here they are. What is your name?" says the captain. "My name is John Waters." "There it is, written on the articles in 2 places, once by the landlord and once by the shipping master." "I never signed those articles," replies John. "No," replies the captain, "you were too drunk to write your name, but here's your mark." John puts his hand on his head and studies a moment and says, "I want an advance before I go to work. How much was I to get?" $125 for the run, paid in advance," replies the captain, "and here's your account from the shipping office. Your bill with the boarding master took $100, leaving $25, which he handed to me to give to you when you get sober." John takes the $25 and goes to work. But you ask, what did the land shark give to the sailor to take away his senses so completely? It was a compound of whiskey, brandy, gin, and opium, which if a man drinks, he sinks into the Lethean stream for 12 hours. In days past, when seamen were scarce in this port, very many landsmen, as well as seamen, were thus drugged and shipped. On one occasion, a shoemaker stepped up to the bar to take a drop and waked up the next day at sea and did not get back to his business for 9 months. A brickmason, as I was credibly informed, was thus shipped in the hurricane. Again, a drayman left his dray in the street and went in to take a nip and saw his dray no more. I was told that a Spaniard with his long spurs on was thus shipped on the Clipper Contest, Captain Brewster. It happened, however, that they had not given him quite enough, and by the time they got him aboard he recovered and showed fight, whereupon the shark knocked him down. But Captain Brewster, a humane gentleman, would not suffer such cruelty aboard his ship, nor take the Spaniard against his will. So the long-spurred hombre vamoosed. A man boasted that having stabbed a fellow, he had escaped a term in the state prison by drugging and shipping his victim before the trial came on. How many homeward-bound miners have been thus drugged and robbed and shipped, eternity will reveal. Again, there are some men in California who will not drink rum, and the Shanghaier cannot dispense with the services of such, and the question is, how will he get hold of them? Well, sirs, they have what is called the Shanghai cigar, which is thoroughly impregnated with opium and other poisons. The smoking of one is equal to the dose of chloroform, with more lasting effects. I will illustrate the practical importance of the cigar by a single case. A landlord, lacking men to take up a crew, met a German glazier on Long Wharf with a pack of glass on his back and said to him, "Hi, my good fellow, don't you want a job?" "Yes, sir." "I want you," the shark said, "to put some glass in the stern of that ship," pointing to a ship in the stream. "Jump into my boat here, and I'll take you aboard." So off they went. As the German sat in the stern of the boat, much pleased with the prospect of a good job, the shark said to him, "Will you have a cigar, sir?" "Yes." So the glazier sat and puffed away as he used to do in his fatherland, but before they reached the ship, he tumbled over in the bottom of the boat. The shark threw his pack of glass into the bay and, running alongside, hailed, "On deck there! Lower away and haul up this man!" A rope was lashed around him and he was hauled up. The shark ran to the captain's office saying, "Captain, I've got a first-rate sailor here. He's a little boozy today, but he'll be all right tomorrow." And he got his advance. The poor German waked up at sea with a longer job than he had engaged for, and the worst of the business is he must not only work for nothing, but be kicked and cuffed through the whole voyage for having the presumption to impose himself upon the ship as an able seaman when he knew nothing about the business. These are the principal modes of drugging, but they employ various other modes of shanghaiing so that it is almost impossible for a man in any kind of communication with them to escape. A sailor who was well acquainted with their arts boasted that they could not shanghai him. One day a landlord said to him, "Tom, the clipper ship Blank has made up her crew and is ready for sea. I am just now going to see her off. There are some of your acquaintances on board, Bill Evans and Jim Jacobs. Wouldn't you like to go aboard with me and see them before they leave? We'll be back in a few minutes." "Yes, sir," replied Tom. "I would like to see the boys. I have business with Bill." "Very well. Jump into my boat." So off they pulled. On deck, Tom ran into the forecastle to see the boys, and the shark ran into the captain's office, saying, "Captain, I have brought you a splendid seaman, the best man in port, and that makes up the compliment. Here's his name on the articles." So he delivers the papers to the captain and leaves. In a few minutes, Tom comes on deck to go ashore, and lo, the boat was gone. He had nothing to do but obey orders and get to work. Thus, to drown men's souls in rum, to poison, enervate, and destroy their bodies, and rob them of all their hard earnings, and leave their widowed mothers, wives, and children who are dependent upon them to beg or starve, is perfect sport for the land sharks. The great man-eater of the deep is satisfied to get the stray carcass of a sailor occasionally, but these dry land monsters must take soul, body, and estate of all the sailors, if possible. You ask, why do not the sufferers have the fellows arrested and brought to justice? Because, 1, a man neither likes to confess that he was drunk nor that he was so silly as to be duped and drugged, and 2, he lost his senses so suddenly and has been absent on the voyage so long that he cannot think of one witness by which he can prove anything. And 3, the whole fraternity is so powerful that the peril of an attack is more to be dreaded than a shanghaiing. Arrests have, however, been made frequently here, as you are all aware, and sometimes justice is in part dealt out to them, but it is hard to get evidence to convict them. You must say again, surely these California land sharks must be the worst in the world. I know not, but I have heard of some very bad ones in all our large ports. Captain E. told me but a few days since of the mate of an English ship which came to New Orleans, who was drugged and the next day found himself at sea in a strange American ship, shipped as a common sailor before the mast. Another case he gave of a man who was put aboard, as it was supposed, dead drunk and his advance wages drawn, but the next morning the captain tried to wake his man up, he found that he was dead and had been for a day or two. But you inquire again, why do sailors put themselves in the power of these fellows and allow themselves to be so imposed upon? By the attractive power on the sailor of false sympathy, promises of money-making, liquor, old acquaintances, bad women, etc., he is induced to desert his ship and go to the home of his dear friend, the sailor landlord. According to law, as a deserter, he can be arrested and sent back to his ship and made to perform the rest of the voyage for which he shipped without wages. So there the landlord gets him. None of your cutting up about me. I'll tell your master where you are and have you back on that ship before you can say Jack Robinson. The crestfallen sailor gives in and is as humble as a whipped dog. Again, the landlord says to the shipping master, you must ship your men from our house. If you don't, we won't let you have a man when you want him, and you are to give us no trouble about those bills against the sailors. The shipping master is dependent and must work into the hands of the sharks or be cut out of business. Now then, if a decent sailor has independence of character enough to resist all the other snares and selects a good boarding house, he goes to the shipping house to ship. The shipping master says to him, where do you board, sir? Uptown, at the Widow Blank's. We don't need men right now. You can leave, sir, says the shipping master. The poor fellow cannot ship except through the shipping office, and they won't have him there because he doesn't board in the right place. Now, there are exceptions in the rules of the trade we have exhibited, and there are among boarding masters some pretty decent men. But we have here revealed, we believe truthfully, as the result of long personal observation and good authority, the general working of the system of shanghaiing. This system, the same in principle in all large ports, varies in its practical operations according to local circumstances. The term shanghaiing, as remarked in the commencement, is of Californian origin and was introduced in this way. A few years ago, as many of you remember, it was very difficult to make up a crew in this port, especially for any place from which they could not get a ready passage back to this land of gold. Crews could be made up for Oregon, Washington Territory, the islands, and the ports of South America, for from any of these places they could easily return. Even from Canton, they could stand a pretty good chance of a direct run back. But from Shanghai, in China, there were seldom ever any ships returning to California. To get back, therefore, from Shanghai, they must make the voyage around the world. This was getting quite too far away. Hence, to get crews in Shanghai, except enough of Lascars to get the ship to sea, they depended almost exclusively on drugging the men. Crews for Shanghai were therefore said to be Shanghaied, and the term came into general use to represent the whole system of drugging, extortion, and cruelty. Father Taylor, in this historic sermon and in his writings, was the earliest person of importance, but not the last, to attack the cruel process of crimping in San Francisco. He was also, in the above paragraphs, the first to describe the system in clear detail. Moreover, he had some remedies for the whole bloody mess. First, he wanted a good seaman's home under a board of trustees. This would be a haven not only for the distressed seamen, victims of shipwreck and destitution, but a real home for all seamen. Here they could be amply protected against the sharks. Taylor felt that the disorderly boarding houses, in order to compete, would have to reform and imitate the sailor's home. To the home would come skippers for sober, reliable, expert seamen, and there the honest shipping master could at last compete with the land sharks. Taylor worked hard for a sailor's home, and eventually it came into being. The preacher also demanded reforms in American shipping laws and practice. He was particularly incensed over the misuse of the sailor's advance. The idea of advance wages was designed originally to benefit the ship's hands by giving them the means of buying necessary clothing for a voyage. But with his advance given in the form of a check on the shipping office, which could not be paid until he had gone to sea, the sailor was obliged to find someone who would accept his check, and with a healthy discount, of course. In some cases, the advance was a dead loss to the sailorman, with the land sharks making him take it all out in bad whiskey. Taylor favored doing away with the advance system entirely. He would have each captain lay in a good supply of clothing for the crew in the slop chest. He also urged the captain of each ship to be provided with a copy of the ship's articles and that copies be placed in the shipping offices in the hands of shipping masters. He wanted men to have the right to go aboard a vessel and hire on, just as any other laborer would take a job. The last suggestion which William Taylor made was that all landsmen, Christian or otherwise, quote, should extend the hand of friendship to the men of the sea. Quote, let them labor as diligently for their physical improvement and for the salvation of their souls as the land sharks do for their ruin. Much patience will be required for this work, he admitted. For the sailor, so often wronged, is very suspicious. The Bethel Methodist Episcopal Church did its best to carry out Taylor's program, first on the church ship Panama, moored at the foot of Davis Street, and then at the foot of Mission Street. In 1857, the church built on its deck was taken down and re-erected on Mission Street between 1st and 2nd, where it continued to look after Frisco's seamen as best it could. Taylor's Bethel was joined by an ally on March 26, 1856, when the Ladies' Aid and Protection Society was founded, quote, for the benefit of the seamen of the Port of San Francisco. Mrs. C. Thomas was its first directress, with her office at 80 Davis Street, Hillman's Temperance House. By 1858, the group called itself the Ladies' Seamen's Friends Society. Its object was to establish a boarding house for seamen, a home for them, and a place of protection from crimps. The sailors were to be surrounded by moral and intellectual influences. The destitute were to be supplied with clothing. The sailors' home opened February 10, 1857, and though it wandered about in terms of location, going from Front Street between Broadway and Pacific to Davis Street between Clay and Washington, and thence to the corner of Vallejo and Battery, it never lost sight of its goal. The women hired some honest seafaring men to supervise it, men like Superintendents Captain W.H. Abbott and Captain James F. Stewart. Within 4 years of its opening, 4,975 sailors had boarded there. The Sailor's Home was something of a showplace of the town in the 60s, and the editors of the San Francisco City Directory called attention to the establishment, saying, quote, the house has always presented a neat appearance. The sleeping rooms are in good order, a well-supplied table, and every comfort afforded that the income of the boarders would admit. The Ladies' Seamen's Friends Society was a benevolent organization with religious overtones.
The good ladies wished to ameliorate the condition of seamen in San Francisco by, quote, affording them protection from imposition. They were all too aware that, quote, the men of the sea, an invaluable class to all merchant countries, are subjected by the nature of their avocations to hardship and deprivation, moral, social, and intellectual. Yet another ally for the seamen appeared in March 1860 with the organization of the San Francisco Port Society. This was an out-and-out religious organization rather than a benevolent or charity group. The Society's first president, H.P. Coon, announced its object as the moral improvement of seamen by supporting the Mariners Church of San Francisco in the corner of Sacramento and Drum Streets. Their interest in sailors was limited to bringing religion to them. The Reverend J. Powell of San Francisco was long associated with the San Francisco Port Society, and he did his bit for the sailors as Taylor had done. But when he was in New Haven in 1898, attending the 50th anniversary of his Yale class, the Sailor's Magazine and Seaman's Friend could not help but notice and report that the tone of his talk was hopeful, with the exception of his references to crimping and the failure of all efforts to suppress it in San Francisco. Rowell expected passage of Senate Bill 95, which would guarantee the seaworthiness of vessels, offer two watches, alternating except in emergencies, to provide the hands with comfort and rest, and prohibit unnecessary work on Sundays and holidays in safe harbor, senseless work labeled discipline. Forecastles would, by the bill, be improved in space and warmth. As for crimping, Rowell would only say, just as soon as enough shipowners, captains, mates, seamen, and others in interest can individually be made properly indignant at the wrongs inherent in the present system of shipping sailors, an assembly will be set against them, and fancy can hear the rafters of the assembly room ring with hot denunciations of that system. Vigilance leagues will watch the execution of the law, and the systematic robbery of seamen will have an end. Rowell ended his talk with something akin to a prayer. Oh, that sailors themselves, by the worst kind of contributory negligence, would not play into the hands that throttle them. Proof that the ladies and Father Taylor had not by any means won their battle in the 1850s and 1860s, proof additional to that supplied by Rowell in his Yale address, is to be had in the career of Reverend James Fell. Fell came to the Golden Gate from England to find that many of the seamen drifting about the Embarcadero were callow English boys. In 1892, he founded the Seamen's Institute to improve the condition of sailors on the San Francisco waterfront, since the port had become, quote, a special dread to the mothers of young sailors in England. At first, Fell's salary was paid entirely from English Church Mission Society money, but eventually, when it became evident how dedicated a man he was, a number of shipping magnates kicked in money and also lent their moral support to the Institute. After 5 years of strenuous and remarkably successful labors, Fell returned to Old Blighty, and his place was taken by a succession of chaplains, including Fullerton, O'Rourke, Carney, Liebenrude, Wingfield Digby, and Allison. One of them, the Reverend Frank Stone, began the work of turning the Seamen's Institute over to the American Episcopal Church, but the great earthquake and fire of April 1906 destroyed the Institute's building and all plans for the transfer. Bishop Stone then bought a lot on Stewart Street, the street of sailors' boarding houses, on which the ashes had hardly cooled, borrowed money, and built a substantial new Seamen's Institute. Finally, in 1913, the Institute was transferred to the American hands of the Women's Auxiliary of the California Diocese, which gave it necessary financial backing. Some of the old-timers still going to sea, like Captain Fred Klebgant of San Pedro, remember the old Institute with its rosy-cheeked girls. Decent girls, serving sailors donuts and coffee with a dash of religion rather than the rot-gut fish and chips and dollop of sex commonly encountered along Frisco's waterfront. By the time of World War I, when the need for outside help for seamen was at last beginning to decline, the Episcopalians could proudly claim nearly every ship entering the port and thousands of sailormen on board ship and on shore were cared for, guarded, and benefited by it, not only in San Francisco but at Port Costa, where the English grain ships used to load, as well. But the Institute was James Fell's baby. He was opposed to crimping in general and the shanghaiing of English seamen in particular. A particular abuse of the system was the crimping of fuzzy-cheeked brass bounders, apprentices in their early teens. Fell was also the devoted enemy of gouging haberdashers or tailors and of British ship captains who refused their men pocket money for shore leave in San Francisco. The haberdashers, carefully selected by ship's captains, would usually have their holes in the wall in the lower end of Kearney Street, near the lowest and roughest dives, and in the Reverend Mr. Fell's words, within a stone's throw of the most immoral streets in the city. These tailors, just like the crimps, regarded merchant seamen as legitimate prey, with no closed season on them and no thought that they were, to quote Fell again, born expressly in this world to be fleeced and robbed. As soon as a ship arrived in harbor, a uniform announcement would appear in the papers. Neither the captain nor the undersigned consignees of the above-named vessel will be responsible for any debts that may be contracted by the crew. Seamen were bad risks, and legitimate tailors often turned them away because their credit was no good. They well knew that British seamen, unlike American sailors, usually had their wages withheld from them until they reached home, or until they had put in 3 years aboard a particular vessel. They simply had no pocket money to spend in SF. Men were occasionally paid off British ships in San Francisco after the 3 years when the vessel was laid up, but since it was considered a privilege to be paid off in a foreign port, the lime juicers most often were docked 1, 2, or even 3 months' wages, ostensibly for the expense of later hiring men to replace them. The American system, of course, was to pay off a crew in each port of arrival. Occasionally, an English captain would allow his crewmen a little pocket money, perhaps $1 a week, the pay of a messenger boy in the 1890s. A few gave $2 to $4 a week, and many gave not a red cent, deliberately egging the crew to desert just to run the men out of the ship. When a crew was a little hard to bamboozle, a captain would hire a boarding master to run his crew off his ship. One crimp showed the crew the paper which bore each man's name and the amount he would get from the captain for causing them to desert. When Fell talked to the captain, saying, "I suppose your sailors ran away in Frisco?" The master answered, "Yes, we've had 3 crews this voyage. Wages were paid only to those who took her home from San Francisco to Liverpool, of course." Of course. The men were run out of the ship so that they would forfeit their wages and thus save the owners money. The ship's masters used all kinds of devices to encourage desertion during hard times, such as the Depression of 1893, for example, when grain ships might be laying up for months without a cargo. Pocket money was denied the men, and no tailor money given them. They were forbidden shore leave, nagged, and overworked until the exasperated seamen welcomed the crimps with eager arms. Small wonder that in the 1890s, between 800 and 1100 men deserted their ships every year. In 1897, a large number of British ships were laid up from 6 to 8 months or longer owing to bad freights. Many crews deserted, others were paid off. They took their wages minus 1 or 2 months' pay, which was deducted for the expense of the master in hiring new men in 6 months from some boarding master. Paid off at the British consulate at 506 Battery Street, the sailors found their friends from Kearney Street and the Barbary Coast waiting for them at the very consul's door. The crooked tailors so regularly overcharged the poor sailor that it became the custom, the rule, to charge a commission on any sailor's bill, running up a 4-shilling pair of dungarees to 5 or 6 shillings. A Port Costa selected haberdasher gave them schooners of steam beer as a token of his esteem, but arranged with the corner saloon to put their drinks on his clothing bill. The captain of their ship would pay him and deduct the sum from the amount coming to the seaman. Fell realized that there were a lot of ne'er-do-wells on shipboard. He once wrote, "There are, of course, a number of men who are regular birds of passage, who seldom or ever make a whole voyage in a ship, and they always expected to desert." But he knew that the vast majority were not of this stripe, and he fought valiantly for his belief that British merchant seamen were entitled to regular wages, at sea or in port, just like Royal Navy men. He once asked a boarding master what would be the result if seamen were allowed a week's wages each week they were in port. The boarding master's answer was, "Oh, that's a different ticket. If they got half that, not half of them would desert their ships." During slack times, Fell saw the crimps sitting on Vallejo Street wharf day after day, for long hours at a time, devising new plans for benefiting the hundreds of sailors arriving each month. Or he would see them lurking frequently and patiently on Lime Juice Corner. Why did San Francisco's crimps vie for the privilege of causing a poor, penniless limey to desert? The answer is that while the man had no money or valuables on him, his carcass was valuable. Yes, the sailor, pound for pound, was a most valuable piece of merchandise on the San Francisco waterfront, and he was bought and sold and stolen. By a rule of the Port of San Francisco, seamen who shipped on a long voyage were required to leave behind 2 months' advance pay, £8, paid in advance and deducted from their wages, which would finally be theirs at the end of the complete voyage. The seamen were supposed to get this advance for their own needs, but only after lodging and clothing bills were settled. There was seldom any hereafter. Usually when the tailors and boarding houses finished robbing them, they would get not so much as a plug guinea. The 8 pounds did not go far among the boarding master, tailor, shipping master, runners, and all of those guys. There were a few exceptions to the rule, and Fell knew of one or two honest boarding house keepers who were not only honest, but also charitable enough to keep a seaman in a boarding house well fed when he otherwise, in slack times, would have to beg, steal, or go hungry. Letters were sent to the London Times in 1897 to show the profit made by owners by running their crews off their ships in San Francisco and other foreign ports. One captain was violently hostile toward Fell and the Seamen's Institute because, quote, "you try to persuade the men not to desert their ships." Fell's Seamen's Institute, set in the middle of Boarding House Row at 33 Stewart Street, was a success from the start. He was not able to lick the Shanghaiing system of San Francisco, but he did make the English merchant tar's life in port more comfortable and secure. With the opening of the Institute on June 2, 1893, the merchant seaman had a USO-like program set up for him. There were billiard tables, bagatelle games, British books and newspapers, tobacco, concerts, Sunday services, athletic events, mostly sack races, three-legged races, egg and spoon, blindfold, and lemon races. To wind up a strenuous evening, Fell would organize tugs of war between groups of brawny forecastle hands. There were picnics on the 4th of July, Washington's birthday, and Queen Victoria's birthday. On Christmas Day, there was always a huge feast, enjoyed by 200 or 300 men on the average after football games on the Presidio Parade Ground. New Year's Eve was, of course, a big night at the Seamen's Institute. Fell began a program in 1893 which, by the time of the 1906 earthquake, was a real threat to the organized Shanghaiing gentry. Coupled with various other legal, political, and economic forces, it helped eventually to topple the crimps from their control of the waterfront and its laboring force. The handwriting was on the wall by 1898. In that 1 year, British seamen placed $1,300 in cash in Reverend Fell's hands at the Institute, either for safekeeping or for transmittal to England. Oh, how the crimps cursed that Anglican padre! Of great satisfaction to Fell was the decline in desertions from British vessels. Before the Seamen's Institute, for example, an average of 60 apprentices a year would jump ship. After 1893, the average dropped to only 12 a year. That's our reading for today. This is the first half of Chapter 2 of Richard H. Dillon's book, Shanghaiing Days. The chapter title is Sky Pilots and Pencil Pushers. We've talked about the sky pilots. I have stopped just at the point in the chapter where he's going to discuss the pencil pushers. That is, the authors and writers of the day. So this is a special Thursday book reading from the Offbeat Oregon History newspaper column. I know, it's mostly about San Francisco. San Francisco's not in Oregon, but it is germane because, of course, they're both West Coast ports, and also because Portland and Astoria more or less inherited the crown, if you could call it that, as Shanghaiing capital of the world after San Francisco, through a combination of the sky pilots we were just talking about and that horrible earthquake, sort of gave it up. It passed Portland, and it remained in Portland pretty much through the end of the Shanghaiing era. All of the techniques and strategies that were pioneered in San Francisco were played out and refined in Portland and brought to even greater heights. Very interesting industry. So for more about Shanghaiing, there are several articles about this topic on offbeatoregon.com, which is my newspaper column website. And also I write about it extensively, or I wrote about it extensively, rather, in my book, which is called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, which you can get in the usual places where you get books. So if you're interested, check that out. If you're interested in Richard H. Dillon's book, I'm working on a complete audiobook reading of the entire thing, which I will make available on my website when it's done. It may be a little while before that happens, though, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. This is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, a public history service for the state we love, broadcasting Monday through Friday of every week. For more information or to subscribe to it regularly, you can look it up on iTunes, catch it on Stitcher, or punch up ofor.us/p. Well, that's all I've got for you today. And if you tune in tomorrow morning, that's Friday morning, I'll be posting a brand new Offbeat Oregon column, so you've got that to look forward to. And until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.